Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne, and both of the stories in this episode feature heroic rodents. Our first story is from the wonderful storyteller Dovey Thomason. It's a story from the Haudenosaunee, the people of the Longhouse, the First Nations tribal confederacy of the Northeast. And the story sets itself up by giving us a picture of Haudenosaunee women coexisting peacefully with the mice who live in their homes. Now, for anyone who's ever set a mouse trap or called an exterminator or yelled eek and jumped up on a chair at the sight of a mouse, what could possibly make humans feel okay about sharing a home with these little critters? What wonderful thing might mice have done to make them welcome? Well, that's the story, and we think you'll love it. Here's Dovey Thomason with Mice Make Peace.
While I'm among the Haudenosaunee, I'd like to tell another story. My background, by the way, is Lakota, Apache, and Scottish Gypsy. And the answer to that, my grandmother explained to me, is when I asked her why she married a Scottish man, she said she didn't. She said she married a storyteller. So, storytellers all the way back. But Grandma was the best. So if I do anything right today, it's because she's right back here. Yeah. Mice have always lived in the homes of the people. So it is. Mice have always lived in the homes of people, and the homes of the people among the Haudenosaunee, the long houses, the round houses, the homes where the people live are owned by the women. And the women of those homes know there are mice in the homes, and they know those mice are mothers. And so they let corn fall from their hands before they grind or before they make soup. They let corn fall from their hands that the mice mothers will have food so that they may be strong enough to feed their babies. And there was peace between the mice and the mothers still, the two. And so it was that as time went by, the young men of the village grew impatient. They grew angry. They looked at the corn they had. They worked in the fields with their mothers. And then one day, one of the young men was saying to another young man, it's like, I'm tired of working in this field. I am tired of growing corn. Are you? I think I'd like to go fight somebody. And his friends looked at him and said, what? How do you think that is a good idea? We live by the law of the peace, the great tree of peace. We live by the law of peace. Why would you want to go fight somebody? Well, just
bored. Fighting would be good. I mean, I'd be stronger if I fought more often. People would fear me if I was stronger. Others would like me better, I think. Women might like that. Maybe they'd tell stories about me. Ah, telling stories about me. That would be good. That would be, songs would be better, I think. Songs of a great hero. And his friends were talking to him and said, this makes no sense, what you are talking about. This is all about for you. He goes, well, if we had a fight against our neighbors and took some of their corn, we'd have more corn. That would be good for everybody, not just me. That would be good for everybody. And his friend said, we would fight our neighbors? Well, they have too much corn. What kind of neighbors would have more than we have? That's not right. I think we should take corn from them and then we'll have more. That logic didn't persuade his friends. And they resisted him for a while, but young men sometimes can be lit afire by the words of other young men. And so it was. The young men said, I've been thinking about, what do you think? It's like, well, I don't know. It sounds like I'm tired of working in the fields. And the other said, well, a song would be kind of nice, And soon the young men
were overheard. Now, everybody says that you can never keep a secret because of the wind. That the winds go everywhere. That the wind that is touching us today will keep going all the way out, as our voices do, all the way out to the very stars. It never stops, but the wind goes slowly by us because we are often saying things that are fun to hear and shouldn't be repeated. Maybe shouldn't be said. And the wind had heard the words of these young men, but they weren't alone. It was not only the wind. The mice mothers had heard this, and they looked at one another and said, uh-oh, this is bad. War, very bad. Bad for the corn, bad for the crops, bad for the mothers, bad for the houses, bad for the... No. We don't want war. No. It is the custom of the Haudenosaunee that the young men who have not yet been to war take counsel from the elders, from the fighters, from the warriors, from the generations that have protected them in times of great need. And so the young men went to their fathers, their grandfathers, their uncles, and told them that they wanted war. And those old men sat back and said, "You know nothing. You know nothing of war. Have you lost a friend in war? I have. I have lost friends in war. I have been afraid for my own life in war." And one by one, the man said, "You miss your children in times of war. You're far from home in times of war. It is a terrible thing. You are talking of songs and stories and more corn than you can eat. Ha! You do not know anything about war. There should be no war." Now, I'm sorry to say, in those times, and perhaps even in these, sometimes young men don't listen to the wisdom of their uncles, their fathers, their grandfathers. And so they went to the clan mothers, because among the Haudenosaunee, every decision that the chiefs or men can make can be vetoed by the clan mothers. And so they went to the old women, their mothers, their aunties, their grandmas, and the clan mothers, often mothers and aunties and grandmas, and they told them what they wanted. And they were not quite as fierce. They were not as aflame when they talked to their mothers, and their mothers looked at them and said, "Bored? Oh, bored feeding your family? That's something. Where did you ever get such a thought? More corn than you can eat. They are not our neighbors because they have more, because their sons work harder. If you want more corn, work harder. Your mothers, your aunties, they could use the help. There will be no war. You don't understand. There can be no war. I will not lose a son, a grandson, a nephew, a boy of this village. I will not lose a generation. No, no. We have spoken and you have heard. I hope you will listen." And so the boys went away, young men went away. And I am sorry to say, in those times and perhaps in these, sometimes young men do not listen to their mothers, their aunties, their grandmas, their clan mothers. They gathered in a cave, and there they started to make weapons. They started taking stones and napping them into points, flints, sharp. They started lashing them to sticks. They took sticks and turned them into arrows. They fletched them with the feathers of birds, turning them into weapons. They took sticks from great trees, and they bent them into bows, and they lashed them with sinew from deer they had hunted until they had bows and arrows. They had clubs with stones. And all the time, that one man, that young man who was so afire, kept saying, "Tomorrow, tomorrow we attacked our enemy." No longer were they neighbors. Now they were enemies. No one argued with him. No one disagreed. They were making their own weapons. They were all as aflame as the fire that they were working around. They said, "First thing at first light." And he said, "Yes, yes, first light. Grab your arrows, grab your clubs, grab your bows. We will make our fathers prouder than they knew they could be. We will make our mothers see that they were wrong, that this was the right thing to do. Listen to me, my brothers, my fellow men. We will be warriors in the morning, after we sleep." And so they put their weapons in a great pile, and the fire burned down, and they curled up in their robes around the fire, and the mice were listening to everything. They looked at one another and said, "Oh, dear, this is very bad. This is very bad. Do you hear how they are talking? They are going to do this. Didn't listen to their fathers, uncles, grandfather, bad enough, but they didn't listen to the women. Oh, I don't understand. What are we to do? We are mothers. What can we do? But if there is war, some of them will not return. And if there is war, there will be less food. And if there is less food, some of our own will die. We cannot have this. We must help these people make peace. They do not seem to know how. How are we going to do that?" And one of the mice said, "I don't feel really strong. I don't feel, look at them, they're big. Kind of scary to me." And another mouse said, "Well, I have teeth. So do you. You too. We have teeth. Our teeth, they're keep a living, keep us living, keep us working, build our houses. We have teeth. We can dig in town. Our teeth are strong. Our teeth are, well, as strong as parts of their weapons." Looking at those club heads and at those arrowheads, that little mouse just hesitated for a moment, doubted himself for a moment, and he said, "But we have to do something. We can't do nothing." And he crawled up on one of those bows, and he started to chew on that sinew. And he chewed and chewed and chewed until that sinew, he chewed all the way through, and that bow lost its curve and was just a stick again. And the other mice looked at him and thought, "I can do that." And the mice swarmed over that pile of weapons, and they gnawed and they chewed. There were no stone tips, no arrowheads on those sticks. Those feathers were taken home for nesting beds for babies who needed them better than anybody needed a war. And they gathered all those things until there was just stick and string and stone and rock. And they hid, ran away back to their babies, carrying feathers for their babies. And when the young men woke up, the first one to wake up was the one who most wanted to go. And when he woke up, he saw a pile of weapons gone. "Who came and took our weapons? Our enemies learned of our plans. Our enemies came and struck us in our sleep. Who would do that? They deserve anything horrible we can." And the others, his brothers, his friends, they looked at him and they looked at one another and they thought, "Oh, that is not who visited us." For they thought, truly, it was that spirit of peace in whomever carries it in their hearts, that spirit of peace, be it pure, be it... He did not know, but they had been stopped because what they were doing was wrong. And so they went to their mothers and asked if they could help in the fields that day. And that young man perhaps calmed down after time, perhaps not. Perhaps young men like him are amongst us to this day. I do know the mice are still with us. And I do know that if they come into your house, try to think of them as those Haudenosaunee women do, as little mothers. And don't always clench what you've got too tightly in your hand. They brought us peace.
That was Dovey Thomason with Mice Make Peace. You know, there are a lot of stories that are about small characters doing big things. Little mice bringing about a big peace. Stuff like that. But one of the things I love about Dovey's story is the deliberation of the mice, the thoughtfulness with which they try to figure out what might be best to do. Making peace is hard, especially when it runs against the grain of what some of the people want. And though Dovey's story is about mice, it made me think about the family of cats that lives in my backyard. I've talked a little bit about that cat family here on the show. It's a family of feral cats that was born back there. We've watched them grow up. We give them food. We work with the Humane Society and with veterinarians to deliberate about what would be best for these guys. And all the while we're expending all this energy seeing to their well-being, for a long time, these cats wouldn't let us touch or pet them, couldn't get close to them almost. They're feral, after all, wild. And there's a part of us that says, if only they knew how good it must feel to have someone stroke the fur on your back or scratch you under the chin, they'd realize that we're right and that they should give in and be regular old cats. And then one day, my wife reached down in a quick, vulnerable moment during a feeding time toward Sammy, the big, curious orange and white cat that's part of this cat family. And she stroked his fur, and he kind of liked it. And that has led to a tenuous kind of interaction between us and Sammy. He'll let us pet him a little bit most mornings. And super excited about that, we wondered if we could make the same kind of headway with Sammy's sister, Shadow. And so one day when Shadow's head was down over her food, I reached out and stroked the gray fur on her back. And she didn't run away. The next day, I tried the same thing, and again, she stayed still under my hand, eating her food, letting me stroke the fur on her back. And super excited about that, the next day during feeding time, I just picked her up for a moment. I held her securely and gently and stroked her under the chin. Oh, I thought, we're going to be pals. This is huge. And I told my wife about it and our daughter, and we all kind of celebrated a little bit. And the next day, and well, every day after that, when I've come out into the backyard, Shadow has scurried away under the fence. I had moved too fast in picking her up, it looks like. It was a step backward, not forward, in the peace process. We're kind of back to square one. I'm learning from Shadow that peace takes patience. It's hard. It's long. And it's not at all as simple as just saying to the other critter, just try it my way. You'll see that I'm right. And it's much more complex than that. There are things that the other critter wants and doesn't want, and those things need to be honored. And the change and growth required for peace takes time. Time and thoughtfulness. People who are serious about peace think about peace pretty hard. Maybe I've got the patience it takes to make peace with Shadow. We'll see. I hope so. That's where Dovey's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? You know, in an episode that's already featured some rodents as prime movers, here's another. This one is from Alton Takeyama Chung. Alton has Japanese roots and Hawaiian roots, and he tells folk tales and historic tales from both of those places and from other places too. But here, he tries his hand at kind of a tall tale about a classroom gerbil named Fred. And the tallness of the tale will be clear to you in almost the moment that Fred comes on stage. But behind the anthropomorphic little furball is a story about middle school science club, about model rockets, about things that go boom, about adventures with friends that may just bring to mind some middle school memories for you, even if you never met a gerbil in real life. Quite like Fred. Here's Alton Chung with a story he calls Model Rocketry.
When I was in the fifth grade, I joined Mr. Furuno's science club along with my best friend Kyoki. Now, we met after school in Mr. Furuno's science class, and he did his best to try and teach us a little bit more about science. Now, the science club had a mascot, a gerbil, and it became my job to take care of this gerbil. And this gerbil was wicked smart. I mean, what I would do, I mean, I'd give him little treats, right? I mean, he was so smart, I called him Fred with a PH. D. I mean, I'd give him little bits of fruit, whatever they gave us for lunch, and whenever I'd walk in about lunchtime, he'd stand up on his hind legs, put his hands behind his back, and he'd be pacing his little aquarium, expecting his treat. And if he liked it, he'd give me a smile and a thumbs up. If he didn't, he gave me a frown and a thumbs down. Now, apples? Good. Raisins? Not so much. I also got him and began carrying him around in my pocket, just for fun. And I swear, he would sit there and poke his head out in the middle of conversations just to freak people out. Now, I also took Fred home on weekends. Now, my best friend Keoki lived across the street from me, and in his garage, he had an old aquarium that he wasn't using. That became Fred's weekend home. I remember when I just put Fred in there, all of a sudden behind me hear this,
oh, is that a mouse? Oh, gosh, what happened to his tail?
Ah, it was Stuart and Steven, the nosy, tattletale, identical twins with perpetual colds who lived up the street. I said, he's not a mouse, he's a gerbil.
Ah, who would want a mouse with a stubby tail?
I swear, I saw Fred kind of roll his eyes, turn his back on the twins, and burrow into the wood shavings. Now, one day at Science Club, someone brought in a package of Oreo cookies. And Mr. Furuno said, you know, if you could take all that sugar in that white creamy filling and turn it instantly into energy, you'd have enough energy to go and power a model rocket. Keoki and I were really into model rocketry, and our ears picked up, and we said, no way, Mr. Furuno! Mr. Furuno was so pleased that we were actually paying attention. He started telling us how to do this. He told us step by step. We asked all kinds of questions. We took notes. Mr. Furuno told us everything what we needed to do because he even figured that us little kids would never be able to get our grubby little hands on really dangerous chemicals like potassium nitrate. Mr. Furuno didn't know about our friend Patrick. Patrick was one of those guys who could get you anything. And we needed potassium nitrate. So, we got to see Patrick. We told him what we needed, and he explained what we're going to use it for. And he said, great, he could get it for us, but he wanted in. Keoki's garage became Rocket Central. Now, Keoki wanted to make a small rocket go up and be a couple hundred feet. But Patrick and I, we wanted a big rocket go up a couple thousand feet with a payload, cone, and everything. We sat there and we followed Mr. Furuno's instructions and we took old used rocket engines with a ceramic cone and we packed it with our own Oreo rocket fuel, but we had a problem. We needed a little ejection charge. Something, when the rocket reached apogee, which is the highest trajectory of its flight, we needed something to go and a charge or push the nose cone off, separate it from the body and deploy either a parachute or a streamer so we could recover the rocket. Patrick looked at us and said, no problem. A couple days later, he came back with a can of gunpowder. I'll probably do it. He also came with a length of detonation cord. This is what they use to set off real explosives. We had our ignition system. Now, what I would do, we'd work on these things, and after everyone went home, I'd take Fred out of his cage and let him walk around the table. And he sat there and he'd look at all their plans and he'd get up behind and put his hands behind his back and he'd look at all the unfinished rockets. And of course, he heard everything we were talking about as we were building these things. And one day he walked right up to me, put his hands behind his back and just looked up at me. I said, pretty cool, eh, Fred? Now, hey, Fred, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to even put in the payload. I mean, Fred, want to go up in the rocket? That's when I became the payload specialist. Let Patrick finish working on the engines, and Keoki really wanted to build the rockets. But I had to go and take care of Fred. I had to kit out Fred. I found a G.I. Joe flight helmet and visor. It fit him perfectly. And I got the flight suit that I had to go and, you know, cut down the arms and legs and stitch in elastics to make cuffs. And for safety, I got a G.I. Joe parachute pack that fit him. And I got one of those red parachutes, an extra one that we had built for the rockets, and rolled it up and stuck it in there. And for his emergency chute, I got a G.I. Joe medical kit strapped across his belly. But it was too small to hold another parachute. But I rolled up this plastic streamer, and it fit in perfectly. And to finish the ensemble, I got a G.I. Joe K-bar knife and strapped it across his chest. He looked pretty spiffy. No. Now came launch day. Now, it just so happened that the government was putting in Hawaii's first interstate freeway, the H-1. just down the street. They had torn up miles of houses and left this huge boulder field. I mean, some of these rocks were about the size of small houses. It made the perfect place for a hidden launch site. We grabbed all our stuff, put it in a shopping bag, and we headed off down the street, and we almost made it. When we heard,
"What you guys doing? Is that a rocket? Can we come?"
Oh! It was Stuart and Steven. We had to invite them along, otherwise they'd go and squeal on us. So we went into that boulder field. We found a nice launch area. Now, Kyoki set up the launching system, and we sent Stuart and Steven downwind. They're going to be our recovery team. And Patrick, well, he's going to walk around the middle distance just to get a good view. And Kyoki, he had his father's binoculars. He climbed up on top of a big boulder, and he was our spotter. Well, we sat there, and he put his little rocket, we called it the Micron, a small little rocket, onto the launching system. I cut a piece of deck cord, I stuck it into that nozzle of our rocket propellant, and I lit it. Shh! Went up, oh, big smoke trail, going up a couple hundred feet, and we saw it arc over, and we heard this little pop, and the nose cone separated from the body, and all of a sudden this streamer deployed. Perfect launch. Stuart and Steven recovered the rocket. Oh, everyone was happy and excited, ready for the next launch. And now came our turn to fire off our big rocket. We called it the Demon. We set it up, and Fred was riding my pocket all this time, and I took him out, and I put him in the payload. He settled in, and I got some extra lettuce to act as extra padding or in case he got hungry. And he got all set up, and I set up, and I looked at him. Stuck in that dead cord, and I lit it. Oh, big smoke trail going up. For a few seconds, it's just a little tiny dot up in the sky. Oh, it was going up and up and up. And then... the sound of the explosion echoed off the houses. Kyoki got so startled, he fell off the boulder. He landed on his arm. He kept going, "Ah, my arm, my arm, my arm." I looked downrange. Stuart and Steven were gone. I looked, Patrick was gone. And then I looked back up at the debris cone. I saw this little flash of red. And I ran over to Kyoki. I grabbed over the binoculars, and I took a look. Unfortunately, the strap was still around Kyoki's neck. And I look, oh, yeah, it was Fred. That was Fred parachute. And there was Fred. But something was wrong. Fred's parachute was on fire. And as I looked, Fred had pulled that K-bar knife and was slashing at the parachute shrouds to cut himself free. And now he was free, and now he's falling. And Fred was about to become a gerbil-sized strawberry pancake. And I watched, and all of a sudden, oh, he pulled his emergency, and now this brilliant orange streamer was marking his flight and slowing him down. And I let go of the binoculars, much to Kyoki's relief. My arm! And I began running. I tracked that stream. I saw that stream was going to fall. I began running toward it, and I saw it would fall. It would probably land right about there. There was this 8-foot pit, wide pit with all this rebar sticking out at kind of weird angles. Fred was about to become a gerbil kebab. And I'm running along. I'm thinking to myself, with a running start, I can probably leap 8 feet. The plan was, I'd run, time it just right, get to the edge of the pitch, leap, snag the streamer, land on the other side, and avoid, all these rebars of death. So I timed it. I saw that thing falling. I launched myself up into the sky. Did I mention that I'm a klutz? The tip of my sneaker snagged one of those rebars, and I started twisting this way. The streamer started going that way. I twisted it in mid. I reached out, grabbed hold of that streamer, pulled it to my chest, and landed on the other side of the pit. I was a little dazed, and I realized I'm holding something to my chest. Ah! Fred! I took off his helmet. His eyes were closed. Ah! CPR! I've never done CPR on a gerbil before. Ah! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Breathe. Do I pinch his nose? Ah! I grabbed his whole head, stuffed it in my mouth, and blew. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then Fred opened his eyes. Fred, are you okay? Oh, I was so relieved. I got Fred, I put him in my pocket, I grabbed all his gear, and I began jogging back to Kyoki. Kyoki was on the ground, still holding his arm, screaming, and all of a sudden I heard a new sound. Woo, 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 woo! I looked around. There were police cars coming from all directions, closing in on us. Oh, we were in such big trouble. I grabbed all our stuff. I threw it in a shopping bag. I grabbed Kyoki, and we kind of wove our way through that boulder field, evading the police, trying to get home. And I said, we got to come up with a good story. Okay, here's the story, Kyoki. Some other kids, we wanted to see some other kids' skateboards. And they wanted to see our model rocketry stuff. So we brought our stuff. We showed it to them. We played on their skateboards. You fell off and broke your arm. Good story. Okay. We get to Kyoki's garage, and there's my parents, there's Kyoki's parents, and I'm about ready to launch into the story, and from behind them I hear... I look behind them. It's Stuart and Steven. Ah! I had to tell the truth. We never saw Patrick again. Heard that he transferred schools. Kyoki became the most popular kid in the fifth grade because all the girls wanted to sign his cast and, like, find out, hear the story again of how he broke his arm. I got grounded for the rest of the school year, had to quit science club, and was probably going to go to another school the next year. I did see Fred one last time. The last day of school, I snuck into Mr. Furuno's science class, and there was Fred in his aquarium in the back. He had a little desk, and he had a stack of wood shavings all with writing all over him. He had a little ink pot, a little quill pen, and he's scribbling away another piece of wood shaving. And I walk up and say, hey, Fred, what you doing? And Fred kind of looks up, and he smiles, and he points with his pen at the corner of his aquarium. And there is a flight helmet on top of a neatly folded flight suit. And I said, Fred, I may not be able to see you again. I'm probably going to go to another school. Fred thought about that, and Fred stood up. Take care of yourself, Fred. Never saw Fred again. I hope he got his book published. I mean, he deserved it. He was, after all, the first gerbil knot in the state of Hawaii.
That was Alton Takayama Chung with Model Rocketry. Has one of your friends ever had a crazy idea that had you jumping right in without perhaps carefully considering the consequences, like Alton and his pals? Have you ever tried to find a good way to keep people from fighting like the mice did in Dovey's story? Did you ever build a model rocket? Or anything else exciting? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them in the show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. We want to thank Dovey Thomason and Alton Takayama Chung for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. While you're waiting for the next Appleseed episode, try Kaboom, another BYU radio podcast. It's filled with audio adventures for everyone in your family to enjoy, wherever you get your podcasts.